History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. They don't have to go untold if we're willing to do something about it before it's too late. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we do that, we're educated, we're always entertained, and we can draw inspiration from these stories from our men and women in uniform. Today's episode was recorded at a military museum that you may not have heard of, but you should definitely add to your list. It's the MacArthur Museum of Arkansas Military History in Little Rock, which happens to be the building where legendary General Douglas MacArthur was born way back in 1880. We're going to hear more about the museum on an upcoming episode, but today we get to hear from a gentleman who was twice awarded the Purple Heart while serving with the 1st Marine Division in the Korean War. 94-year-old Alfred DeChico spends a lot of time with his Army veteran son Tony in Little Rock today, but he grew up outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
I came from a place called Black Horse. It was an Italian conclave, and if you didn't speak Italian, you were lost. The whole neighborhood, they seemed to congregate there. I went to grade school there in Black Horse, and then we went into town in Rittenhouse Junior High School, and we went to Norristown High School. And from Norristown High School, we went in to Philly joined the Marines, but we joined it close to Christmas time, and they told us to come back first of the year. Mm-hmm. Four of us joined at the same time. At that time, they had selective service, and we were going to be drafted. So four of us joined, two of us come back. They sent us to Parris Island. And Parris Island back then was nothing but World War II wooden barracks. We did our thing there. And we went to Lejeune. And from Lejeune, from 2nd Marines, they anointed our head with oil and said we were 1st Marines. So we went to Camp Pendleton. In Pendleton, we trained and we trained, and they put us on troop ships to Japan, Kobe, Japan, and we stayed there for a couple of days, the whole fleet, the whole division. After maybe a couple of weeks or a month, the division starts circling. And we were told we're going to make an Incheon landing. Well, Incheon landing was kind of different. Some of it was beachhead, and some of it was high tide. So I came in on a high tide. The North Koreans have pushed the 1st Marine Brigade way down south. So General Mack come up with an idea, why don't we send this division and other army to cut them off? And we cut them off. We took Seoul, we took the airfield, took everything. And we kind of had them mashed in, but Pentagon, somebody said, back off. So we backed off, and we kind of let the North Koreans come back and up to North Korea. I think I came in on the third or fourth wave on an LST. Got sick on the LST.
A little seasick?
Yeah. So the night I came in, I was fortunate enough to get about a bunch of rockets. And rockets, maybe 10, 20, 30 rockets at a time would fly off. They would shoot them rockets off, and they would pick up and leave and go someplace else. But the North Koreans knew where the rockets were coming from. So we had a tough couple nights. When we took Seoul, we took the airfield and blocked them in. We lost a few men. I was in light 30s machine guns. We pushed them. We fought. We took village after village. And one thing led to another, and combat in Seoul. And it got so that we, for months and months, it was take one city, go back, take another city. We had a terrible incident where guys got caught in their sleeping bags and they were bayoneted. I was wounded. They sent me back to the hospital ship, and then they discharged me and I went back up. And about that time, we were going up to the Chosin Reservoir. Truman was emphatic about us, and we were ready to jump off. General Mack was going to jump off to the Yalu River, but Truman said no. One thing led to it was so cold, so cold. We weren't really equipped. We had no flak jackets. We had everything from just World War II stuff. We had a lot of retreads from World War II. It got so cold. We were freezing. And my regimental commander was Chesty Puller. Chesty was, I guess, maybe in his 60s. He says, we're not surrounded. We're just attacking from a different front. Yeah. It got so bad, we were freezing. And we had a big 6x truck, and Graves registration were just, they were all frozen, and they stacked them in there. But we fought our way back into some troop ships or something, and we didn't leave anybody. I think somebody said to me that they were going to try to bury some of them, but you couldn't bury them. It was just frozen. So we went back to the ships, went back down south, and somebody got into a hand grenade, and I got hit again. And this is tough. On the rotation of coming back, they told us that anybody that made the Incheon landing and Chosin Reservoir would be immediately sent back to the States. I was an unfortunate guy that stayed 14, 15 months. And I was sent back with the first replacements. We did a lot.
Before I say anything else, I just want to say thank you for letting us into your world. Because I know this isn't easy to talk about. Let's go back a little further to maybe some things that might be a little easy to talk about, because it'll give us some perspective on who you and all those other Americans putting their lives on the line were. So you were born during the Great Depression. I don't know how much of that you experienced or heard stories about. Can you give us a taste of what kinds of things you did as a kid?
During the Depression, it was the aftermath of the Depression. I was born in 31. But within a couple years, WW2 started. We were rationed food, gas, tires. We recycled metal. We had Victory Gardens as a teenager. You name it, there was, in order to buy meat, you had to have red stamps. But we were all together. I mean, the people that were sacrificing were there. My brother-in-law was in WW2. My brother was in WW2. My dad was in WW1. We made do with everything. I mean, recycled bicycles, we put them back together. Skateboards, we put them back together. And it was tough. But during 45, when the war was over, it still was rationed. We still had, you had to have gas cards or gas stickers on your windshield to get gas, and you had to go a certain days. I can't think of anything that was not rationed. A lot of servicemen came during WW2 on the war bonds, and we had a lot of war bonds, more bonds to drive, but nobody had any money. Well, every able body was in the military. We just had a tough time, but after the war, 46, 47, it started easing up a little bit, and we start doing our American dream.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about your hopes and dreams, but I'm curious because you mentioned your brother and your brother-in-law were both in World War II.
Yes.
Did you have much of a clue as to where they were and what they were up to?
My brother-in-law was bilingual, and he spoke Italian, so they sent him to Italy. I think he either got a bronze or a silver star, was wounded. My brother was stateside. People that served in WW2 did not or would not talk about what they seen and what they did. And it was things they wanted to forget. Back then, there was no things of flashback or you can go to the Army or the Navy and get some help. You were looked upon if you had some kind of problem. You were looked upon as weak, and that was our theory.
How about your father? You said he was in World War One. Did he ever tell you any stories about that?
Well, you want me to go into it?
I'd love it, yeah.
Okay. My dad come over. I was born in 1896. He come over. He had a sister here. He had about six or seven sisters and one brother. He come over here during the height of the WW1, and he stayed with friends in New York. One thing led to another. His sister kept on telling him, come on. And they lived in Norristown, and he didn't come. So he started hanging around in New York City. And New York City had a big police wagon. Every able-bodied man was put in that police wagon and taken into a federal courthouse and asked to raise their right hand. Half of them raised their left hand, but anyway, he was inducted in the Army. They sent him to Mississippi to artillery, trained there for a while, shipped to France. He had a brother that fought for the Italians, so it was a little different. So what he did was, he was in charge of the horses that took the howitzers. They sent him back to Mississippi or wherever it was, and he hung around, and his sister kept telling him, we have an arranged marriage. My dad went back and arranged marriage, took over the family farm or whatever it was. The Depression hit, and he lost everything, and he came back. My sister was born aboard. Mom was pregnant on the ship coming over. My dad didn't have to go to Ellis Island. My mother did. And we hit him. Me and my brother were born there shortly thereafter.
A lot of things had to happen just the way they did for you to even exist, huh? That's quite a story.
Yeah. We should have all been born in Italy and worked on a farm, but we didn't, and he had the fortitude of telling one of his sisters to take over the farm, and so he did. So he came, and he told me a couple times that everything was done by oxen and horses. And fast forward 100 years ago, Tony was stationed in Germany, and he said, why don't you come over and visit me? He said, I'll buy you the plane tickets. Of course, we went. And we went back to the old place where they were born in the combine. And
so you got a picture of what your life might have been like.
Yes, yes. I'm so tickled that he decided to come to the U.S.
I'm curious, too, though, you know, growing up in the 30s and 40s outside of Philadelphia, I know there are plenty of Italian immigrants around there, but did you ever deal with any anti-Italian sentiment?
Oh, yeah. My mom could not speak English. My mom had a green card. During the height of the war, Italy and Anzio was gone, and I was the only one home. As a teenager, I would take my mom in town, and we spoke Italian, which was not very well. People kept saying that I had my brother in Italy and was wounded, and you're here speaking Italian. Of course, as a teenager, you really respected your elders, and you bit your tongue, and Mom was asking me, what did I say, and what did I say? Kind of hard to explain. Well, my sister was in some kind of woman's brigade or something, but I know she wasn't home during the war. We never had a phone until I was about 15, 16. I had to earn the money to get it installed. And, of course, it was a typical party line, six or seven people on the phone. I remember vividly of going to grade school, first grade, no kindergarten. We had a gal that had a roller about this big. I want to tell most of us were Italians. I'm going to tell you people something, and you better listen. No one, bang, bang, will speak in this classroom with an accent. Show and tell, somebody got whacked. We all lost our accent. But that was then, you know, because she made it happen.
Yeah.
Today, they would probably put her in jail.
Yeah.
For abusing us. But other than the first grade, it was a good grade school, good junior high, good high school. But there again, it was still prejudice to hoodlums and everything. But we learned to cope. The depression wasn't as bad on me as it was on adults, the depression. But we survived.
It's time for our first break, but when we come back, we'll get a taste of some of the situations Alfred DiCicco had to survive three quarters of a century ago in Korea. He's already mentioned he was wounded twice, but we're going to explore more with this Purple Heart Marine when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 94-year-old Alfred DiCicco, recorded at the MacArthur Museum of Arkansas Military History in Little Rock. It's really a gem that you should add to your list if you're ever passing through that part of the country. Mr. DiCicco splits time between Arkansas and Florida now. We've already heard some touch points from his time in the Korean War with the 1st Marine Division, serving under the legendary Chesty Puller as his regimental commander. But we want to rewind a little further to Al's early years in Norristown, Pennsylvania, to give us a broader perspective. I'm trying to think of how to ask this question where it doesn't sound like a stereotype, but every Italian veteran of your vintage that I've interviewed has regaled me with stories of his mother's cooking.
Oh,
was there some good stuff happening at your house?
So you want to go into that. In our backyard, my dad had built a little shack and an oven. An oven that when you made pizza or bread or anything, the wood was in the bottom and the bricks would get hot, and that's how she... Every Monday morning, she would make loaves and loaves of bread, send them to the neighbors or our relatives, a couple of uncles. She also made pizza pies. She made breadsticks. She made a lot of biscottis before biscottis were around. Every Sunday we had pasta. Everybody would come around, uncles and aunts, and at supper time they would happen to be there. But that was okay. We canned a lot of peaches, and sauce, pears. We'd make homemade raviolis. One quick story. I took my wife, who is Irish, and a redhead for my engagement back down. So I told Mary Virginia, I said, listen, when we have an engagement party, do not empty your plate, because the first thing it is, they're going to fill it back up. So she loved pasta. She loved raviolis. She ate a couple, and before she cleaned her plate, I'm trying to hit her, leave some food on the plate. She got two or three more. The same thing for salads and chicken and everything. Back then, she didn't weigh 100 pounds. But when she got out of there, she believes. Yeah, she's a fabulous cook. And she could not, if you walked in, she would feed you and feed you and feed you. And you couldn't say no to her. That would be sacrilegious. Yeah.
So before you ended up as a Marine, did you have some ideas in your head? Hey, when I grow up, this is who I'm going to be, what I'm going to do, the places I'm going to go. Did you have some ambitions in your mind?
I knew very young I was going to be a cop. After the Marine Corps, I joined the Washington, D.C. Police Department, retired from there. Worked a little for the Marshals Department, and I said, I'm not going to do this. Was there doing all the riots? And we had a lot of them during Vietnam, people burning their draft cards, and it was a tough time. Police Department in Washington had 5,000 of us for the whole city. We had U.S. Park Police. We had Capitol Police. We had the marshals, of course, FBI headquarters. It was interesting. I ended up on the K-9 and had the police dog.
Well, and I'm just thinking none of that happens if you don't survive getting wounded multiple times in Korea. But I guess I need to ask you, what motivated you initially to join the Marine Corps? What was it about the Marines that you said, hey, that's the uniform I want to wear?
One of my buddies, Billy Romano. Billy had two brothers that were in WW2 in the Marine Corps. So we ran around, we run it by Pat what we wanted to do. He said, don't join. So the draft board called, or we called the draft board, and we were, the four of us were either 8, 9, and 10. And they told us that within 10 months we were going to go and get drafted. So Billy's brother influenced us to join the Marine Corps. I still think a lot of my buddies that didn't come back.
And you said four of you joined together. Two of you came home, two of you didn't.
Me and Billy.
Who were the other two young men?
One of them was in heavy weapons, bazookas. I don't know whether they still call them that or not. And one was caught in a sleeping bag. Yeah.
And how old were you when you made that landing at Incheon?
17 and a half, 18. The military don't want anybody that's old. They want young dudes. You wouldn't think that when we learned in Korea, the 38th parallel, that we could not settle our civil war. But lo and behold, we went to Vietnam, and we couldn't solve their problem. And we didn't. Went to Afghanistan. I mean, these people had eggheads that are so smart. You think history would say you can't meddle with them. Afghanistan, same thing. You can't solve people's problems if they're internal. I want to talk about something else. When we were in Chosin Reservoir, President Truman told General MacArthur to back off, not to go into China. One thing led to another. General MacArthur was a supreme Allied commander of all the Far East, a five-star general. President Truman called General Mack back to the States. Five-star. He got before Congress and made his famous speech, "Old soldiers never die, they just fade away." It was a trying time for us. We got another, I think, Ridgway or somebody from WW2 took over. But General Mack was the supreme Allied commander. And one thing we learned from him was he could not, the Japanese people, he could not tell them what to do. But he gave the emperor the idea of the how he wanted to rehabilitate the country. And that's how he got everything done. Sad time.
Fitting that we're sitting here in the building where he was born as we talk about MacArthur's legacy. I'm guessing you might have an opinion on how things might have been different if Truman hadn't interfered with MacArthur's plan or vision?
The Chinese back then during the 50s, they didn't have the equipment. Even though five divisions surrounded us, we had an opportunity at the Yellow River to take the Chinese on and win. But President Truman said he didn't want that to happen, didn't want a world war. In fact, he went on to say during the height of the Korean War that was a police action. Of course, he got crucified in the papers and all the medium. But I think we could have won. We could have won. But there was a couple army divisions too with us, and there was multi. We had a Greek outfit, we had Canadians, we had some Germans, I think, not very few. We had some Japanese, but I think we could have won.
Yeah, who knows how different the world might be today. And I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes. You're a teenager on the other side of the world, and you're invading another country. I don't think you've ever done anything like that before. Looking back, how prepared do you think you were for what you ended up doing?
We were well-trained. While I was over there, I had a little girlfriend. We were engaged. I got a Dear John letter while I was over there. I did very close to marrying that gal. Of course, I knew then, and we weren't very respected when we come back. Nobody wore the uniform. We got to remember, we had been 6 and 7 years doing WW2, and people were sick and tired of war. We did not get any flack like they did during Vietnam of child killer or something like that. But we weren't really welcomed, which was really sad. I spoke one time at a local chamber of commerce in Norristown, and I was told, "You got 2 minutes, 3 minutes, don't wear your uniform." I accepted that. Billy, my buddy, would not even go to him. Would not attend any functions. He had the attitude, so I did. But it was sad.
Well, and I'm just thinking back on some of the things you mentioned. You gave us an overview of your experience there, and you lived it, so it might not be as big a deal to you as it might be to some of us. You said you got wounded the first time. What happened? Where were you? Where'd you get hit? And how bad was it?
We got involved in a Pregu or something like that, in a minefield. Everybody was scared to death. We had a couple of them detonated right under a guy's foot. And another one went off, and I was a couple yards away from one. I got ankle and leg problems. Sent back to the rear, and they fixed my leg. And the second time was, I think it was in the city of Seoul, one of them hand grenades, what it was, and I got some of that. And they said to me, "We're going to fly you back." No, they didn't fly me back. 2 months later, I was still there, and I come back on a troop ship. And I stayed in the service, and they asked us, I said, "Where do you want to go?" "Well, you know, we want to go to embassy duty. You want to go? You'll get it." Nobody got anything. I was sent to Quantico and at OCS, and we were instructors.
I'm guessing that those two Purple Heart incidents are not the only close calls that you remember. Are there times where you really entertain that thought? I may not make it back to see my family again?
Many, many. And of course, the theory was if you hear that sucker coming in, you know you weren't going to get hit. Mortars, big 105s coming in, terrified you. When we machine gunners, when our company never stayed actually with the grunts, we were always outside the wire waiting. We didn't have, well, our squad was 12 men, 5 were ammo carriers. And the rest of us were carrying the tripod or the gun or the overall sergeant. After a while, after a couple months, you're always saying, well, I'm invincible. As soon as you got careless at night, because they would never attack us during the day. It was always dawn, always early in the morning, and you could not tell a North Korean or a South Korean. And they abused the kids, let them carry. And there's nothing you can do when it's almost like the enemy is, you can't tell. Somebody might be, we used a lot of them as ammo carriers, and they had these big carriers in it, on their shoulders with the big things in the back, and they would carry all our ammunition. We, after a while, you say, that Yobo is probably the one that fires us at night. We're WW2. They knew who they were fighting. They knew Germans and the Japanese. But we were constantly scared. Another, no other word to, if you tell me you weren't scared. We knew you were lying. We knew you weren't on the line.
I don't know if you're thinking what I'm thinking as we listen to 94-year-old Marine Corps veteran Alfred DeChico describe his Korean War experience, but I'm not sure how many of us would want to trade places with him. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, we'll find out just how brutal the conditions were during the Battle of the Chosin Reservoir and how Al feels about all of it 75 years later. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend. It's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is. Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our eye-opening conversation with 94-year-old Alfred DeChico, a decorated Marine who survived the Korean War's most intense engagements. The toll it took on a then-teenager on the other side of the world from his family was not just physical, but psychological and emotional as well.
Once you're on the line for 30 days or 35 days, they will relieve you and you'll go back to the rear. And they had big tents where 10 or 20 of us with floors on them. And they said they're going to take all the ammunition away from them because we weren't wrapped too tight. They said, no, you're not going to take it. But anyway, we get in this and there was a couple guys from the country. You know what Applejack is? Applejack is a liquor. We made liquor in these five canned jerry cans. Uh-huh. And for some reason, the guys that were running it had put the top down. It exploded. The rear echelon, everybody went bananas. And they were all going to court-martial us. It was a joke. This is Applejack all over the... But that was just one incident. And
Yeah. I bet you can still remember that smell.
Yeah. We were told that we were vacate the tent and everybody else, and they put us out in the boondocks somewhere, or we went close to my. But it was a good time.
Good times in the midst of really challenging times, and that's what I'm wondering. I don't know how easy this is to answer, but you're a teenager, you've been wounded twice, you've seen guys you know killed over there. How did you keep going day to day? What do you think enabled you to continue to fight and ultimately to survive?
The people that you knew got wounded and got end of DOAs, you kind of blocked them out. And any replacements that we had coming in, first thing we told them, don't tell me your name, don't tell me where you're from. I don't want to know. I don't want to get close to you. Because once you found out how close you were to a guy, you, when he got hit, or you just kind of blocked it out. Back then, we didn't have any shrinks. If you had a problem, your platoon sergeant or your regimental commander or somebody would take you in, and if they thought you were losing it, they would ship you back. We had a few guys that shot their foot. I couldn't take it any longer. The thing was that what bothered me was you take a territory, you take six villages, and you back off and you come back. You go back to the train station in Seoul, you take it, and you, within a day or two, you said, get back to your original line. So mentally, it was... You blocked everything out.
And I want to follow up, too, because, you know, you mentioned probably the most legendary battle or situation of the Korean War and one of the most tragic with the Chosin Reservoir. And you talked about how cold it was. Can you give us some perspective on just how cold it was and how you guys, what you had to do to try to stay warm?
When we first got there, there was these air units dropping boots and clothes and heavy things. Of course, they dropped them way out where we couldn't get them. And if we did get them, they got them. Some of the rear echelon people got them. We had boots we had, heavy jackets. But at 12 and 13 below, cans, big jerry cans of gas we would try to stay away. There was no tents. There were just pup tents. You carried half the pup tent, and your buddy carried the other half. And the seat, the sleeping bags were not like they were today. They were just some fur. And there was a lot of trench foot. You had to change your socks at least twice a day. And just to change your socks. And the boots would freeze. Just flat out. And the gun would freeze. The M1s were frozen. Carbines were frozen. But they had this cosmoline stuff you put over them. And the Chinese, they seemed to battle. I mean, they knew how to navigate. And what they did with some of the prisoners we had, what they did was they would give them a little bandolier of cloth, and they would have them put all the rice in there, and they carried theirs. Where we had to have rations, we had to have food, but they can put their whole division out there. And seen a lot of guys froze. If you didn't keep moving, once in a while there would be somebody would have a large tent and have a heat, but it was just keep moving, keep moving. The week or so we were up there is just. And then when we tried to come back at the passes from the mountains, everywhere as we went, there was a blockade. Our company didn't go down the passes. We had the outer perimeter where the snow was deep. But somewhere or other, 4 or 5 miles, we had to blast our way through. It was just a terrible time, terrible time.
Sure sounds like it. And I imagine when you finally did get to come home, even though they didn't fly you home, stuck you on a troop ship instead, I'm guessing there might have been a little relief. What was it like to get back to the States again and see your family again?
We tried our... At least the people that I knew, we tried to drink ourselves. We would, officers got a bottle of whiskey every month. We would try to confiscate them. 99% of the people that I came back with, we drank. And we drank until it was time to sober up. We wouldn't get staggering drunk, but we would get high. We're not proud of it. But I guess in a way that's what we forgot, you know, the way of mentally of coping.
And of course, we've all heard the Korean War referred to as the Forgotten War. You're telling us about it is helping a lot of people learn things they wouldn't learn any other way. 40 plus years after it's put on pause, this memorial is built in Washington, D.C., where you spent your career in law enforcement. I'm sure you've been there a time or two. What do you see? What do you feel? What do you experience at that memorial?
When it first opened up, I went to the opening ceremonies. After they opened it up the first night or second night, I don't recall, I went out there and sat, and I guess, I'll tell you the truth, I cried like a baby. I went there a couple times after, during the day, and you hear remarks and you hear things like that. It's just nasty stuff. There wasn't that many on the force that were Korean veterans. And I tried to explain a lot of what I was going through to some of them. And, of course, a lot of them were W-2 vets or German prisoners. And what they said was, suck it up. That's what I got. Yeah. But I came from another vet. Mentally, I guess I just backed off of everything. But I'm so proud I served my country.
With regard to the Korean War Memorial, most recently, just as of a couple years ago, they've added the names. Vietnam's had those 58,000 names forever, but now the Korean War Memorial has the names of 36,000 Americans there. Is that meaningful to you? Does that make a difference that people can go there and see the names of, like, your two buddies who didn't make it back?
Yeah, you know, the thing is that I agree with the Vietnam troops that they put their names up there, but it becomes so personal when you see some of the guys that have, and you see a name, you say, why me? Why me? So I haven't been back to it for at least 10 years, 15 years. Brings back too many memories. Even as a young man, you just can't forget what you've seen, what you've done. And the kids, teenagers, and whether they're North Koreans or South Koreans, just lived so desperate lives. Korea was nothing but mud huts, and the big cities were okay. But I have a chance. The Korean government says that they will fly me back. I couldn't mentally do that. I just, once in a great while, you get the regrets, and why me, why me? I guess that's what you call depression.
Yeah, they don't give out Purple Hearts for those kind of wounds, but they're just as real. Well, if there's anything I didn't ask you about that you want to include, feel free. I just want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for letting us into your world a little bit. You're 94 years old now. You're still playing pickleball.
Yeah.
When you think back over 94 pretty interesting years, what would you say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
The most proud I am of serving in the military, serving my country. Never forget that. My whole family has. My son has. My father has. Brother have. And I'm so proud of serving our country. Sometimes I have second thoughts, but I am very, very proud of serving my country. And I'll do it again.
I believe
it. I would do it again.
And I have to ask, because you're so with it and active. Is there anything you haven't done yet in those 94 years that you're still looking forward to, still on your list?
Mine on my bucket list? there is, I don't know whether you're familiar with the Arkansas River. There is, what do they call them things, Tony?
Tugboats.
Tugboats that go up and down, uh-huh. And they push all this stuff. I told my son, Tony, I like to get over there and ride one of them things, and they're pushing them up like that.
Yeah.
He said, yeah, Dad, yeah, okay. But, no, there is nothing I haven't done.
Well, maybe somebody's going to hear this and get you on a tugboat one of these days.
yeah. Just for an hour or two, and that's it. I don't want to go up in an airplane like President Bush. He jumped out of a plane, didn't he? Yeah.
Was there anything else that I didn't ask you about that you want us to know?
No, not really.
Have you ever had someone ask you, why does the Korean War matter? Or what was that all about? Do you have a good answer for that?
I used to, but not anymore. Not the way history has gotten to us. Not the way we keep on meddling. And they settled by sending 18 and 19-year-olds. These eggheads in Washington are smart, smart people. But they do not understand. You cannot get involved in a country that doesn't want help. I know I was talking to that during the Vietnam War. I was saying that we just can't do that. And then with this Afghanistan, and then with trying to bail out, disgraceful. But that's our country. We are willing to help everybody, and I'm so proud of our country.
His country is proud of him too, and so is his family, which includes 4 children, 10 grandchildren, and 14 great-grandchildren. 5 years ago, Al lost his wife of 68 and a half years, Mary. The way he cared for her in her final years provided just as powerful of an example for his family as anything he did in the Marine Corps or in life. Here's his son, Tony, an Army veteran, with a final thought.
So he tells a lot of stories in regards to his experience out there, and they're not stories, they're real life, and almost seems like they couldn't be real life, of the sacrifice and that they made during that time frame. Even when he came back as a policeman, starting off the K-9 force, and to be an entrepreneur after that, even get to those pieces. All that is, you can be proud of somebody for that, but what made him real proud is the 10 years that he cared for my mom.
Yeah.
As she went downhill.
Yeah.
That's true service. That's what I would add.
Thank you to Tony DiCicco and his Purple Heart Marine Father Al, and once again to the MacArthur Museum of Arkansas Military History for allowing us to record this interview there. Much more on the museum and why you should consider a visit on a future episode. But that's all the time we have on the radio for today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.